Hey everybody, this is Neil Fallon from Clutch, and you are listening to The Vinyl Guide.
This episode is brought to you by Vintage Media Grading at vmgvinyl.com. Explore how professional grading can protect your records at vmgvinyl.com.
And now, on with the show.
Well, hello there, peoples. It's Nate. Welcome to episode 397 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And today, we are featuring a conversation with Neil Fallon of the band Clutch. Clutch manages the majority of their music through their very own Weathermaker record label, which Neil and I deep dive into today, plus some of the rare records of their career, and the new Sunrise on Slaughter Beach, the complete edition, 7-inch vinyl box set, which is going on sale Friday, June 2nd, 2023, at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Everyone, set your calendar invites right now. And apologies to those of you who are listening in the future because the box set is likely sold out. However, if you're listening to this in early June 2023, head over to clutchmerch.com and grab one of these Sunrise on Slaughter Beach 7-inch box sets while you still can. Again, it's going on sale Friday, June 2nd at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's the full Sunrise on Slaughter Beach album, plus 3 extra unheard tracks, plus custom sleeve art, plus a neato booklet, and that's at clutchmerch.com. So grab that as soon as godly possible. Oh, and by the way, if you're new to the Vinyl Guide podcast, welcome, welcome, welcome. Grab a beer out of the fridge, make yourself at home. We've got nearly 400 other episodes ready for you to enjoy anytime, including interviews with Jay Maskus of Dinosaur Jr., episode 393 of The Vinyl Guide. Jason Bonham shares stories of his dad and playing with the mighty Led Zeppelin, episode 383. Chris Shiflett of the Foo Fighters joined us to talk rare records, episode 382. Gerald V. Casale of Devo, episode 366. Brian Baker of Bad Religion and Minor Threat, episode 351. Kenny Jones of The Who and the Faces, episode 339. John Dwyer of the OCs talks rare records, episode 331. And heaps, heaps more. Just follow the Vinyl Guide in your podcast app for free. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. Alrighty, let's get into our conversation with Mr. Neil Fallon on the new Sunrise on Slaughter Beach 7-inch box set, as well as the other rare records of the band Clutch. Alright, well, ladies and gentlemen, this week on the Vinyl Guide, we welcome Neil Fallon of the band Clutch, who I've always wanted to have on the show, and I'm very excited to be talking to him today because I believe, Neil, there is a release, a special Sunrise on Slaughter Beach 7-inch box set coming out. Is that right?
That is correct. It's coming out shortly. It's a, just as you described, 7 inches in a box. Mm-hmm. The original release plus 3 songs that we tracked in the studio at that time. And they will make their public appearance on this 7-inch box set, which we're pressing up 3,000, I believe, and that's going to be it.
Oh, wow. So people who are listening to it need to skedaddle very quickly over to clutchmerch.com to secure those. I mean, 3,000, that's not a whole lot for a band like Clutch. Those will be gone pretty quick.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, we've made the mistake of sometimes pressing too many, and then they just sit and sit and sit. So it's a practical thing. And also, I mean, a 7-inch box set that has a very specific audience. For people that are, you know, knee deep in this kind of thing, you might think that world rotates around it, but it's a pretty niche thing. So mm-hmm. It's about getting the right amount to the right people.
Yeah. Well, my world revolves around it. It's very.
Yes. So,
now, when you go into an album cycle, you know, Sunrise and Slaughter Beach came out in 2022.
Yes.
And of course, you had 12-inch vinyl records, and the album was available then. Of course, there's been tours and whatnot. But this 7-inch box set has kind of bubbled along for a while and is now kind of popping up in, you know, middle of 2023. Was that a supply chain issue? Was that the design all along to kind of have some air between the two releases?
Yes, it's all those things, you know, to a certain degree. as I'm sure you've heard, you know, the woes of supplying vinyl records, you know, it was really challenging, particularly for a band like Clutch. I mean, we're not, you know, we're not Bruce Springsteen or the E Street Band, and kind of have to get in line behind, you know, huge acts. And the company that we had been working with just kind of dropped the ball in a lot of ways. And we had to then try to establish a relationship with a new company, and Blue Sprocket, which is a pressing company in Virginia, took on this and did an outstanding job. They're hand pressed vinyl records, and hopefully they're going to be doing more work for us in the future. But also, you know, from a practical standpoint, artists will often re-release stuff with bonus tracks in a way to kind of bridge the gap between a previous release and whatever's brand new, just for practical reasons. It makes even more sense for Clutch because we are the record label.
Right.
And this helps us, you know, we tour to, we kind of, we put out albums to support our tours, in a manner of speaking, because we just have not stopped for 30 years.
Clutch has a very unique kind of space in collectability. And I like getting Clutch stuff because I get the feeling, correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the feeling that more of the money that I spend on Clutch merchandise goes to the actual band. You guys control the recordings, the product, everything in this independent model. Would that be right? Am I kind of reading the tea leaves right on that?
That is correct. I mean, when we were young, and by that I mean in the 1990s, we signed to major labels because we were told by, like, opportunity only knocks once. If you say no to these folks, they'll never come again. But we were always living in the shadow of, not shadow, but we always had a point of reference with Discord Records. From the 80s, because we were more or less from around the Washington, D.C. area. So we wrestled a lot with the DIY ethic and people kind of telling us, you know, you need to get on the bandwagon with this. Mm-hmm. I think we're very fortunate that we were able to do both. In the 90s, we signed to these labels. They never knew what to do with us, how to market the band. And I don't really think that really would have made a difference. What made a difference was the internet and people file sharing. And then people who liked the music came to see us and then wanted to buy records. And then we found ourselves in the mid 2000s, kind of starting from scratch, putting out our own records. And it became easier to go directly to the fans. There's a lot of gatekeeping for many, many decades, and those gates got knocked down. And why any artist wouldn't do it this way is beyond me. Sure, it's more work, and you got to own your mistakes, but that's like anything else in life, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And I want to talk about some of those early mistakes, because I'm sure there's some learning curves that you guys went through, and, oh, you'll never do that again. Yeah, you mentioned one earlier, you know, having a box full of unsold records in the garage to, you know, prising up too many. When you're talking about file sharing, did Clutch benefit from the likes of Napster and Kazaa?
Absolutely. 100%. And, you know, the thing is, but if you're talking about bands getting upset about bootlegging, usually, I mean, the people that are upset about that are not really the bands, as it is the people that are trying to sell what they consider a product and nothing else and nothing more. They could get a job anywhere selling product X. And in this case, it happened to be songs. And then they had the A&R representative culture, which was good because, you know, some people had really good taste. It could hear, had a great ear. But at the same time, a lot of talent went unheard. We lucked out, kind of in, got caught up in the post-Nirvana signing frenzy. Not that we sound anything like them, but there was a lot of bands that kind of got caught up in that. Mm-hmm. And the example I always use when trying to kind of illustrate this is, for years, we were told by a booking agent, don't ever bother going to Greece because look how many records you've sold here. Zero. You've never sold anything. And then a local Greek promoter for many years said, you need to come here. You need to come to Athens. And finally, we did. And there was 3,000 people there that knew every word to every song, whether it be something that was brand new or 15 years old, because they have been sharing this stuff. And we were unaware because, well, we can't speak Greek. We're not on Greek chat rooms. But it translated to us being able to go perform live, sell merchandise. No one's really making a whole lot of money selling records anyway. I mean, it's we're not, you know, talking to Taylor Swift here. So it was a matter of finding the right people. And suddenly the internet was the A&R representative, and it became very organic, and it changed everything for us. I never considered it stealing, because ultimately it paid dividends in magnitudes greater than anything that we may or may not have lost.
Yeah. You may not have made a dollar off it, but the mind share that you get from people who listen and share, and they become active fans, and that pays off in other ways. But a band like Clutch right now with Weathermaker Music, you do control your records. You do control your recordings. I mean, that isn't, it isn't a loss leader so much. It's like you say, it's an excuse to tour. But if a band spends time to build a business like you guys have with Weathermaker, then it complements everything. It is something that is growing and helping enrich the band in many ways.
I think so. I mean, to me, to speak, you know, in broad terms, success, or when people say, oh, you made it. I mean, to me, creatively, there's never any making it. You're always looking for something new. But the idea that this is my one and only job, most musicians I know, they do their music in between their quote unquote real job. They do it on the weekends. They do it at night. Maybe they can do a tour every couple of years. For me, that this is all ultimately I have to do is either write music, perform music, or sell the same music to people that enjoy it. Well, damn, that's awesome. And being, you know, the Weathermaker affords us that great luxury. It's more, and it's not just us. We have a great label manager, Stefan Koster, who was kind of got his skills in the 90s with Roadrunner. And he is a vital part of this whole operation.
I also see Weathermaker as, it's another creative outlet. It's not just selling music, but you guys get to do some kind of creative and interesting projects with that music. And the 7-inch box set is an example of this. You've got the Vault series. You've got a few other things that you can kind of stick out there. So it's, the creativity is not just within the music, but the packaging and the presentation as well. So that's got to be rewarding. Yeah,
it is. It's, I have to remember, like, when we were with record labels, you know, that we didn't ultimately make the decision. It was very one-sided. Like, I was always like, I want the album to be like a pop-up book. You know, when you open it up and your fireworks go off. And of course the label were like, what's the practicality of that? And now I understand both sides of that equation. And it's a bit of a threading the needle of finding, you want something that looks awesome, that's, it is quality, but also practical. You know, you start thinking about, oh, this should be a double album. Okay, now all of a sudden shipping rates have increased. You know, it's like, okay, there's the creative side, and then there's the practical business side. And it took, I think, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around that. I'm not really, I think John Paul is definitely more the educated on the business side. He's very savvy when it comes to that stuff. So we collectively, Dan, Tim, and I, and JP, find a vision that makes sense. And if it doesn't make sense, Stefan will say, this doesn't make sense. And we'll take it from there.
He's the tiebreaker.
Yeah, he is. he's the speaker of the house.
So for folks who may not know the full history of Weathermaker. As I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, Clutch had been engaged in several different record labels throughout the first part of the career. Mm-hmm. At one point, there was a record label that defaulted on payment, and the band won the catalog back and then formed their own company, Weathermaker, to then start to put out music from that point forward. And that was in the, what was it, like 2010, 2012, around there. Is that a fair summary of?
Yeah, that's about 2008. But yeah, that's a pretty accurate description. I mean, in the 90s, we signed to several major labels. And then concurrent with the kind of major labels downsizing and cutting off a lot of bands, we signed with a label, and that's correct. They owed us a lot of money. We went to court. We never got the money. So in lieu of the money, we got the catalog back, which started with Blast Tyrant and Robot Hive Exodus and Electric Worry. So that's where we started putting out our records. The ones like self-titled, Transnational, Pure Rock Fury, Elephant Riders, we'll never probably own those outright, but we're currently talking about licensing them to put them out on vinyl.
Okay.
So they'll basically be sort of like an imprint label, although we don't own them with the masters until probably in our 80s, when they'll finally recoup, bequeath them to our children. But now, I mean, I think this last, I mean, with every single release, the 7-inch box set is like Weathermaker release 160 something. I forget exactly what it is right now.
Jesus.
We've put out that many releases. Sure, some of them have been like re-releases or bonus tracks or 7-inches or even other artists, but we've managed to have that many releases, and that's, I think, kind of remarkable.
I didn't realize it was so high. And this is, Weathermaker is largely Clutch and maybe a few related projects here and there, but it's mostly related to the band. You're not bringing in other artists to Weathermaker, at least at this point.
We did do that with a few side projects, and it was great. But at the same time, it's like, I think once we did that, we realized, you know, it's hard to sell music. And we had, when we started Weathermaker, we already had a kind of, it was already baked in for us. And so it was easy to move those records. When it's someone that we're friends with, we think are great, doing anything other than getting the records out was kind of beyond our means. We couldn't really promote much, and we don't want to be the guys on the other side of the desk who are like, oh, sorry, you know, that can poison the well very easily.
Sorry, guys, a double album is going to mean extra shipping costs.
Yeah, exactly. That's easy to have a conversation like that internally. Mm-hmm. But if there was another creative mind who got told no, I know what that feels like, and I don't want to be the no guy. No one in Clutch wants to be the no guy. But to answer my own question, the 7-inch box set is Weathermaker release 164.
164, and you're holding one in your hands right there.
Yep, this was like a prototype. Actually, this one's still in its wrapper. That also includes, you know, some re-records that we did as far as release numbers. Mm-hmm. Everything needs to get its own code. That's what
sure. Stefan
does. Thank God I don't have to do that, because I would botch that.
Now, when forming Weathermaker, it sounds like you've had this getting on, what, 15 years, something like that? My math isn't great. But what are some of the big learning curves that the band had to go through when they started creating and producing and manufacturing their own music?
Well, I will say this. At the very beginning, we started our manager at the time, Jack Flanagan, who had started as our tour manager back in 94, you know, who we spent many hours in a van with, you know, smelling each other's farts, you know, and listening to each other snore and all the disgusting things that happen on tour. And then he became our manager and then our business partner. And he kind of was a very much a mentor in all those things. One of the wisest things he ever taught me is before you ever sign a contract, like you get excited about a new business venture, before you think about how you get into a contract, prior to that, you read it knowing how you get out of the contract. What's the exit when promises aren't met? Because everyone's, you know, feels great about a new idea until things don't go as planned and things can get, you know, very ugly very quickly.
Much like a marriage.
Yes. And that, but that, that kind of had us, yeah, it's like a business prenup. And that definitely had more applications when we were signing to record labels. And then we became our own record label, and that didn't become as much of a as an issue. But learning curves, it's always a learning curve. We want to make everyone happy, and it can become emotional because art ultimately is an emotional thing. And it'd be easy if I were not the singer or the lyric writer to detach myself from the fan who's upset about a vinyl record that is damaged upon delivery. We take it personally. And I think a lot of the learning curve is trying to strike a balance between being both of those things. I've learned one, just, and this probably has a lot of applications outside of anything in life, is surround yourself with good people. This is not a one person job. You have to surround yourself with good, honest people who won't be afraid to give you bad news and be honest. And specifically about vinyl records, that's a good question.
Well, let me put it a different way. You've had 15 years of wisdom. What was one of the bigger mistakes that Weathermaker did?
Well, we've definitely pressed up too many Bakerton Group CDs, which is a side project of ours. And if anyone wants copies of a Bakerton Group CD, feel free to come to Clutch Merch. We will set you up. Vinyl records. There's a lot of moving pieces and there's a lot of mechanics and a lot of things can go wrong. And it cascades if you don't catch it. And you have to always keep your eye on the ball. Never assume anything. And we also recently assumed, we were pressing up some CDs, assumed, let's say it's pressing up a CD. Put the files in. These things get spit out. There's clearly no room for error. Well, it wasn't until many, many, many were pressed up that we realized or we were informed that it was missing two tracks. How that happened, I don't know. So now all of a sudden these things got to get destroyed, which is wasteful. But I think you can't assume anything. You always have to idiot check yourself in all you know walks of life, but particularly when it comes to vinyl production is, it's a 100-year-old industry, if not longer. I mean, it's 120 years old. There's a lot of room for error, even on the best of days.
I understand on one of the recent Clutch Collector series, the Robot Hive Exodus, there was a misprint where one of the records was actually a country artist inside the collection.
Yeah, there was, and here's kind of the wild thing. It's like, that's the pressing plant that did that, we no longer work with for, well, obvious reasons. We didn't know that until it landed in the hands of somebody who bought it. And they're like, what is this? And we didn't know. We had no, and to speak specifically about, you know, pressing up vinyl is not something you can go on YouTube and say, I want to take the vinyl masterclass and learn how to do this. You have to basically be a journeyman for quite some time and learn by doing from someone who already knows. It gets handed down. It's not like learning how to code or things that you can learn online. So many people left that the people that entered into their shoes, didn't have the wisdom or the experience. So you end up with an album that is two artists on the same platter. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous, but it happened. And now I would imagine, because of the climate, that album might be a really special collector's piece.
It is. Yeah.
I don't remember who it was on the side B, but that was embarrassing. That's the other thing. It's embarrassing for us because the fan knows we own the record label. So it's our fault. And sure, we'll own it, even though it was completely kind of an act of God in some ways. Mm-hmm. But you have to say sorry and try to make it right, either by replacing it or saying, hold on to it. It'll be worth a lot more money in 10 years.
Right. But in the meantime, I have to send you another one.
Yeah. And that's it. It's not so much the financial hit as it is just like the reputation that you need to maintain. Mm-hmm. Quality control has been challenging.
And again, Clutch just seems to be the sort of band. I mean, there's an honesty. There's a really strong connection to the fan base. I think that integrity and that respect goes into even the pricing. So, for example, the Oblique box set. Mm-hmm. That was very fairly priced for, what was it? A dozen records or more inside that one box set.
Yeah, there was 12 records in there, I believe. 10 or 12.
It's double digits, yeah.
Yeah.
But that was very fairly priced. And it came at a time where a lot of bands were starting to do box sets, but also almost kind of gouging fans. So developing a box set like the Oblique, designing those sort of products, is that something the band does as a unit? How does something like the box set come together?
That one in particular, we worked with a graphic designer by the name of Kevin White, who's done tons of stuff. He did the artwork for the Pigtown Blues picture 7-inch disc that he actually drew. And he came up with basically what are icons for each album. So there's these circles on the front, which represent the cover of the album in some way, or the title. Mm-hmm. And those are usually, I mean, we'll kind of like, we'll sit around either in our tour bus or at our practice space and talk about ideas. And then we will go to Kevin in that instance and say, hey, we got a rough idea. And the artist will kind of conceptualize that and make it real. Art is sometimes the most, is even harder than doing the damn record. It's because it's forever. And not that the music isn't, but I try to be as involved in that as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Box sets, for the 7-inch box set, that art was all pretty much hand-drawn. So it wasn't something that we could extract layers from a Photoshop file and like change it around. And so we were kind of confined to the parameters of what already existed. But thankfully, 7 inches are pretty small and it didn't like take too much to figure that out.
But each of those 7 inches, as I understand, each 7-inch has its own sleeve and its own unique imagery. Like there's the there's the cover of the album. But then there's variations of that cover on each of those 8 records.
Yeah, what we did is each sleeve is different, and we got the artwork from the gatefold from the 12-inch. And if you can imagine, we kind of zoomed in on a character from the gatefold. Mm-hmm. That was sometimes seemingly related to one or two, either side A or side B. For example, there's a character in there with playing 3 saxophones because there's a song about Roland Kirk called 3 Golden Horns. So that's the sleeve for that 7-inch. And then there's one of a guy holding a Schwinn Hurricane bike. So that's the 7-inch that has Strive for Excellence on there because that's a line from the lyrics. So that's the kind of MO behind that.
Mm. By the way, I just looked it up. Oblique has a total of 18 records,
12 studio and live releases, total of 18.
Okay, so some of them are double. Yeah.
Yes.
There's 12, but some of them are double albums.
Yeah. Frank Zappa talked about conceptual continuity, like characters and concepts going from album to album. And, you know, sometimes the line continues. It's over, you know, half a dozen records. Sometimes it's only one or two. Does Clutch have that? Any through threads that would follow from album to album?
We'll be back after these messages.
There's no doubt about it. Record collecting has become a serious hobby and even an investment for many around the world. So record collectors have to ask themselves how best to protect their prized records and confidently buy and sell with others. There is an option to consider. Vintage media grading at VMGVinyl.com. VMGVinyl.com will professionally grade your record and encase it in protective plastic, so your record will retain its value for decades to come. This is the same approach that comic book and sports card collectors have done for years. Now, I know many record collectors will be horrified with the thought of having their records graded and encased in plastic. And for the majority of records, this isn't necessary. But if you have top dollar records that you need to protect, maybe a super rare album that's languishing on the shelf, a one-off misprint, or a special LP that you want to protect, look up VMGVinyl.com, Vintage Media Grading, and see if this service is right for you. That's Vintage Media Grading, VMGVinyl.com.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. Frank Zappa talked about conceptual continuity, like characters and concepts going from album to album. And, you know, sometimes the line continues. It's over, you know, half a dozen records. Sometimes it's only one or two. Does Clutch have that? Any through threads that would follow from album to album?
Not in a, like a long-term like rock opera sense. You know, it wasn't like we're going to write a songs knowing that this is going to be a concept, like it's Tommy or, you know, Mr. Roboto, what have you.
A bad example.
Yeah, I know. But I like to use it as much as possible. I still have my copy of that record. Anyway.
Every used copy I find of Kilroy Was Here, it looks almost unplayed.
Yeah, well, there's a reason for that. I think they were all, that was actually my first introduction to like colored vinyl, because I remember it came out on like a dark ultraviolet purple that you could only see unless you held it up to the light. And I just remember thinking that was the coolest thing. And that actually was the coolest thing about that record. But anyway, I digress.
Deeply digress.
Yeah. what were you even talking about? Oh, yeah.
Through lines.
Sometimes I like it when I hear like blues guys reference themselves in the third person. I always thought that was cool. And there's instances where I have referenced other Clutch lyrics in a song. And it does give the kind of appearance of a grand concept, but to be quite honest, it's not a grand concept. It's like self-reference just as a tool. And it, mm-hmm. it does kind of create the idea of like world building, but I couldn't tell you what that world is. I mean, the closest thing to that in a grand sense is on psychic warfare. There was X-ray visions and Firebirds. And then on Book of Bad Decisions, there's a song, In Walks Barbarella. And those three songs, I purposefully wrote lyrics thinking of them as sort of a trilogy. And that's fun because they're kind of, that can be the hardest part about writing lyrics is when you listen to the music and you look at the blank page, you're like, okay, what now? You know, the inspiration doesn't fall out of the blue. Usually you have to work at it. And if you can say, okay, well, can I continue an idea I already had? That takes a lot of the heavy lifting out of it creatively. Or it can.
Does the band typically, do the songs start with lyrics, with riffs, with song ideas? How does a typical Clutch track come together?
It's usually riffs or a beat that inspires a riff, and then I take it on. I am admittedly the slowest and squeakiest wheel as far as lyrics go, maybe because that's my job. I write the lyrics, and you know, I do write music as well, but I'm always kind of wringing my hands of, but try not to repeat myself conceptually. I might repeat myself in melody or rhythm, but conceptually I try to change it up. And there are times where I have a lyrical idea and write it down, and it'll sit there sometimes for years. I mean, on the last record, Sunrise on Slaughter Beach, there's a song called Jackhammer Our Names. And I wrote the first draft of those lyrics probably 6 or 8 years ago. And I was just waiting for like, okay, this is going to be, we're going to write a moody song one day. Because of the nature of the lyrics, it wasn't going to be an upbeat party rocker. It was going to be something much more kind of gloomy. And that's how that happened.
When you were young, you mentioned Styx Kilroy was here, and as well as Discord Records.
Sure.
Like, what did your record collect? What did teenage Neil Fallon's record collection look like?
Well, before I was a teenager, my parents, along with millions of other young American families, signed up for Columbia Clearinghouse Records. You get, you know, one penny, you get 28 tracks, and then you're obligated to just buy and buy and buy, and to get out of the contract was impossible. But I remember my parents not being able to decide what 20th 8-track to get on their sign up. And I remember choosing Blondie's Auto American. So that was, I guess, technically the first album I bought, even though it wasn't with my money. I wanted that one. I listened to my dad's records, which is kind of typical of his generation, with Fleetwood Mac, Bob Dylan, the Beatles. And then when I became old enough to buy my own records, well, then I got, you know, I would remember getting like Police Synchronicity and Eliminator on cassette, and Van Halen's 1984 on cassette. By the time I was later on in high school, and there was a record store not too far from where I live called Yesterday and Today, which is kind of locally very legendary. And that's where all the hardcore and punk rock stuff was. And man, it was a lot of Minor Threat and Fugazi and Bad Brains. That's that when I kind of came into my own and wanted to rebel against whatever preceded that. That it's kind of typical. So when you're an adolescent, you want to have something that is your own. And that's kind of how the cards fell out. Listening to the Bad Brains at intolerable volumes to punish my little sister. Yeah.
So you'd bring those records home. Were you going to hardcore shows as well?
Yeah. We were all a bit young to go to like the kind of the golden age of DC punk, like Minor Threat and Void or even Black Flag or anything like that. But later on, there's a lot of bands we saw that it was names I can't even remember, but I saw Fugazi more times than I can count. And we were very spoiled in retrospect, because I was like, oh, this is the local band. Every town's got a Fugazi, and that's just not the case. They were, I think, a really, in hindsight, very influential on Clutch, because what they did was they would play in the weirdest places, usually like community centers or churches. No production, no lights, no merchandise, certainly no bar. And they would burn down the house every single time. And it kind of, I didn't know it at the time, but it just goes to show, it doesn't, you don't need all those bells and whistles. You can just deliver the goods sonically and emotionally and physically. And those, I remember those shows more clearly than what I saw on my iPhone this morning. It was a great first impression about live music. And there was other scenes in DC at the time, like the Maryland Doom scene with bands like The Obsessed and Pentagram, Wretched. Yeah, it was a good place to cut your teeth as a young band.
I think knowing Discord and knowing what I know about Weathermaker, there does seem to be that kind of link of integrity with the fan base. I would imagine that you and the rest of Clutch from a very young age kind of were inspired by that model of fan fulfillment in a respectful manner.
Yeah, you have to respect the fan. And that's not to say you write music saying, oh, this one will be really popular. You have to be, at its very genesis, the creative process has to start with a very private and sincere impulse. I want to make something that's just, I want to create something, not out of a design for financial gain, or not out of design for popularity, but out of design to make something new. And if I like it, maybe other people will like it too. And thankfully, that's the case for us, where we like the music we make, and there are other people who like it too. That I always remind myself that it's the song. It has to be the song first. Everything else follows. But if you get it backwards, thinking, oh, we got to write a new record because we haven't put one out, or we got to write a new record because it, no, you have to write a new record because you feel the creative urge to. And I can see from a mile away when that's not the case with an artist. And Clutch fans, I've seen bands open up for us that who don't sound anything like us, that they love because they can sense the sincerity. And I've seen the opposite when it's clear that that band is just going through the motions, and the Clutch fans will eat them alive. And yeah, it's I think honesty and being true is really important, particularly in an age where it's easy to deceive.
Yeah, I think people have a sixth sense for sniffing out inauthenticity. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't know why, but you just know something's off. And I guess one of the things, thinking about it, Discord, Weathermaker, even like Ipecac Records or Epitaph, the distance between the artist and the people who manage the label, the distance is either non-existent or minimal.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it also has to do with work ethic. I mean, a lot of bands want a label to baby them. Mm. I just want to be told where to go and to, wheel me up on stage and wheel me off, and that's good enough. It's easy to use the label as a boogeyman or something to blame, as a scapegoat for all your shortcomings. And sure, we've done that. We learned about that. And sometimes you have to be very honest with yourself, like, well, maybe you can work a little harder. And like most things in life, the harder you work, you get better returns. There's no excuse for laziness. And there's a bit of a mythos about like the rock band just not having to do jack shit other than their set. Yeah. If you really want to make a life out of this. I'm 51 years old and I've been doing this, you know, most of my life. It's like the expression of, if you do something that you love, you'll never work a day in your life. That's bullshit. If you do something that you love, you work even harder to keep it that way. Mm-hmm. That's the way I look at it. And sure, it's not always easy, but man, it's fun.
So back to Weathermaker, you mentioned there were some recordings that Clutch does not actively control. And those are the ones that are before Blast Tyrant, I think.
Yeah, it's everything from Transnational up until Pure Rock Fury. And we're currently talking with about getting a licensing deal for Transnational Speedway League, because those have been pressed on vinyl, but they weren't very good.
Right. Okay. How about the Pitchfork single?
We own that.
And
yeah.
You own that? Okay. Yeah. All right. Because I believe in the mid-90s, there was a 12-inch. Was that the that had Pitchfork and a couple other tracks on
Yeah,
it?
That was Megaforce. We put out a release of Pitchfork and Lost Needles, which is the original 7-inch, and some mm-hmm. bonus tracks. And that was sort of a one-off. And it reverted back to us. And now that we own it, we've repressed it.
Okay. The Clutch self-titled, that was only released on vinyl in Europe. Is that one of the things that you think will come back, or there will be a license?
I certainly hope so. I mean, there was the, actually, I think the, I could be wrong. I mean, this is close to 30 years ago, but I believe the only vinyl might have been released in Japan. Because at that time, that was the only market that was actively buying vinyl, because CDs were everywhere. And to convince a label to press vinyl was like pulling teeth. Then there was a repressing on vinyl. Actually, there's probably some in Europe. Come to think of it, there's probably some in Europe as well as Japan.
Mostly Europe. The first one.
Then there was this thing called music on vinyl. And that's kind of more recent. That was a repressing of that.
Is the band involved in any of those music on vinyl reissues?
No.
Okay.
No, and it's also weird. Like this is sort of the kind of strange, you know, dystopian music industry future that we live in. Like the labels that we were signed to in the past, we'll find out when we are going to release a new album. And then miraculously they find some way to ride those coattails. Like suddenly there's a Spotify list, you know, a playlist of all, it's like it gets pushed really hard because they can pay the premium to get the algorithm to push a playlist, which is all music that we don't own the masters to, that's promoting albums that we don't own. And some of it's like music that we forgot about that mm-hmm. they managed to dig up. There was one, I guess it was when we released Sunrise on Slaughter Beach, a playlist on Spotify came up with, had an astronaut on it with like a pot leaf or something really awful. It was really cheesy. So that, you know, that stuff does happen too. And
right.
I think they realize they're not going to press up vinyl for Clutch. I mean, they can probably make more money by licensing it to us than mm-hmm. just letting it sit and collect dust. No one's going to get a promotion in their career over it. But there's lots of Clutches out there, but only a few that are in our position where we're actually the label.
Is there anything missing out of the Clutch archives? Any songs or master tapes or anything that you don't have an awareness or may have been destroyed or somewhere?
The only one that immediately comes to mind is when we recorded the Elephant Riders. We did it twice. The first time we did it in our house in West Virginia, and it was really, really out there. I mean, the songs are super long, very proggy, There wasn't a radio single for a mile in any of that stuff. And we delivered it to the label and they're like, oh, hell no. No. You come up to New York and record with Jack Douglas, which we did. And to be honest, I think we kind of had a bitter attitude because we kind of thought we did an awesome job. And Jack Douglas is a world-class producer, and he kind of had his hands full with a bunch of very sullen 20-somethings to do what ultimately became the Elephant Riders. And there are one or two tracks on there like Muchas Veces and Cracker Jack, which are from the original. But to answer your question, I don't know the status of the master tapes of the original. Actually, they're ADATs. The ADATs that we used for the Elephant Riders. I think JP may have them, but that's something. It may be looking at like an old diary entry. I kind of want to listen to it with one eye open first. Because I know I was in various states of chemical disrepair at the time.
Well, I think the first thing is if you find those masters, you got to get them backed up somehow, because that ADAT video, those are video VHS tapes.
Yep.
Yeah, those will start disintegrating if they haven't already.
Yeah, I think, yeah, and now it's, you've got to put it on the cloud, because even putting it on a hard drive, those things break, and then it is gone forever.
Yeah.
That is something that we need to do.
Since you guys are in control of not only the music, but the manufacturing, the product, the physical form media, do you put Easter eggs in there? And without breaking any confidence, are there Easter eggs that people haven't discovered yet within Clutch albums?
You mean as far as like the artwork?
Well, there's artwork, there's music Easter eggs.
Okay.
There's a few funny things you could do.
Here's what I consider the ultimate Easter egg, because we don't even know where they are. Every record that Jay Robbins has recorded with us, he's done a number, or sometimes he doesn't necessarily produce it, but he, as the engineer, when the band is left for the day or before we got in, he would pick one song, and yet he would put a triangle hit, just a little ding, on the track. And there's no reason for me to think that Jay would lie about something like this, because he's not that kind of person. So I will say that on at least Robot Hive Exodus, there is a triangle hit that no one in the band is aware of. So if the fans can find it, please let us know. We would love to put that one to rest.
That is exactly the sort of mission we love.
Yeah, you would probably have to get like a frequency analyzer to find it. I couldn't, my high end hearing is garbage now, so I'll never hear it unless someone points it out to me. That's a pretty good Easter egg.
Yeah, absolutely. Back to the Sunrise on Slaughter Beach 7-inch box set. I believe this is being called the Complete Edition. So this has the three additional tracks that were tracked at the time. Okay. You mentioned they were hand-pressed records. Are they black vinyl? Are they
different black
colors? Okay.
And by hand-pressed, I mean it's not a machine going, it's more like a tortilla maker. At least that's the understanding I have at it.
And what's your understanding of the benefit of the hand process rather than the machine process?
I guess you could call it just more of a small batch philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think sonically it probably makes a lick of difference. It's just someone who enjoys knowing how something's made in a limited quantity. I think even in our industrial age, knowing that someone made something and there's human energy expended into the finished product does end sort of a esoteric value to it. At least to me, it does.
It's nice to know there was a craftsperson behind.
That's the word.
Something.
A craftsperson. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, Neil, thank you so much for joining us here on the Vinyl Guide. And I want to remind folks that on June 2nd, Friday morning, and I'm going to get an exact time for y'all, Sunrise on Slaughter Beach 7-inch box set, the complete edition, will be on sale. Six hand-pressed 7-inch records with three bonus tracks. These are tracks you have not heard yet. There's going to be a turntable mat. There's going to be a booklet inside. Each record has its own sleeve and artwork. It looks like a beautiful box set. And, of course, the place you're going to need to go is clutchmerch.com. Sunrise on Slaughter Beach 7-inch box set, the complete edition, on Friday, June 2nd. Go quickly because these will not last long. Neil, again, thank you so much for coming on the show. And you're welcome back anytime to talk about any Clutch releases or even a deep dive into Kilroy Was Here.
That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm waiting for. All right. Well, thanks, Nate.
Have fun, yep. Oh, man, what a cool dude. Mr. Neil Fallon, ladies and gentlemen. And again, don't forget, Sunrise on Slaughter Beach, 7-inch box set, clutchmerch.com, goes on sale Friday, June 2nd, 2023, at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So set your calendar invites. Don't miss out on this box set. It's got three unheard tracks, so I think this is going to go pretty quick. So grab one while you still can, and grab some other Clutch merch, too. They've got some very killer shirts and whatnot. So, yeah, I'm loading up my cart, and I suggest you do the same. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoy this podcast, please consider becoming a supporter at patreon.com/vinylguide. We always put extra stuff up there for the folks who help us support the show. Extended episodes, commercial-free episodes, high-resolution audio files. We throw up a bunch of extras. We're going to have a birthday show coming up. And, of course, you get the warm, fuzzy feeling of helping support The Vinyl Guide podcast. And that's hugely appreciated. patreon.com/vinylguide, and we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.